Okay, while people are getting ready to for Venerable George Chernoff to arrive, I'd like to read the prayer list for this week. Prayers for health, happy birth, rebirth. All those killed by natural and man-made disasters, all the Tibetans that have been killed or have taken their own lives in the struggle for religious freedom, Geshe Sopa Rinpoche, Venerable Losam Cherki, Dr. Diane Kelson, and Andy Chauvin, Sally Comer, Ray Allen DeMarcy, James Foley, Wendy Johnson, Shyamali Mitra, Stephen Sutloff, Robin Williams, Grissimi the Cat, Scooter the Dog, Job Search. Lothan Barona, Joy Gooch, Joe Griffiths, Jim K., Michelle Magich, Alex Schwartz, Greg Weaver, Sandy Rimbush. Prayers for health and well-being. Khyabji Lama Zopa Rinpoche, Venerable Makanju, Venerable Cherki Lamo, Venerable Losan Tsering, all those harmed by natural and man-made disasters. For the Tibetan people and for the Chinese authorities, may the nonviolent path lead to full reconciliation and religious freedom. Phil Alford, Russell Allen, Ahmed Elkser, Mrs. Askew, Lisa Baranski, Jim Barnes, Luce Barona, Narcissus Barona Sr., Roseanne Barona, Bob and Rochelle, Kitty Burke, Willa Cherrett, Diana Dietzler, Chisano and her children, Anna Clark, Dimitri Diamandopoulos, Suzanne Diamandopoulos, Diane Foreman and son Brad Wolf, Gigi and AC, Jimmy Gooch and family, Mildred Gooch, Robert Gruber, Tracy Haas-Thompson, Kathy Hayashi, Francis Hayashi, Leslie and Joan Inman, Nick Jablins, family of Wendy Johnson, Kenny Jackson, Buddy, Helen Kasanoff, Jessica Kasanoff and the Pritzdahl family, Nina Kowalski, Shanti and Kurt Latimer, Mary Lojek, Danny Love, R.M., Juden Martin and Andrew Martin, Tom McGinnity, Scotty McLean, Catherine Meyer, our mayor, Sarah Miller, Colleen Mitchell, family of Shyamali Mitra, Evan Myrtle and family, William Oliver, Jay Pandya, Cindy Parrish, Anna Papard and her many cousins throughout the Ukraine, Ken Roman, Eileen Rubin and family, Ariana Scott, Rosemary Cease, Sarai, Basil Shoot, Nancy Sorbit, Freddie Todd, Lopsan Topten, Brady Ware, Dion Washington, Jessica Whitmore, Olivia Wilson, Shay Wokowicki, Dorje and Cadro the Pigs, and Grady the Dog. So if you've never been to the center before, Venerable George will be coming in through this door. So when he enters, if you'll please stand, and then you'll see him prostrate, and my sense is that we'll be prostrating after he sits, he goes to his seat. And if you have your phones on, if you please put them on vibrate or mute or turn them off so as not to disturb the teachings. Now, often Venerable George will ask for questions or comments, and if so, if you please wait for Chris to bring the microphone to you. Okay, this is all right.
Have a nice, intimate group this morning. If you're sitting in the back and you want to, you can come up closer to the front. If you feel comfortable where you are, that's okay. So, if this were a class where people were coming all the time, I'd say, you have to sit in the front. So, Venerable, do you have some prayers you're going to lead?
Yes, I do. Okay. Before I begin with the prayers, I'd like to thank our sponsors and say their dedications. The first sponsor is Hannah Yosef. I dedicate the teaching to all sentient beings whose minds are weighed down by depression and to Geshe-la's long, healthy, and happy life. Pat Long, to welcome Venerable Joy Chernoff to Kudampa Center. Anonymous, for the long, happy, long, healthy, happy lives of our dear teachers who show us the path through word and example, and out of their vast kindness will be with us and all sentient beings along the entire path to enlightenment. So if you take the white prayer book, there's only one prayer book, it's easy, and go to the first base sheet, and you'll see a couple prayers at the very top. So let's recite Shakyamuni Buddha's mantra three times, and the four immeasurables in English one time. Taya ta om mune mune maha munaye soha. Taya ta om mune mune maha munaye soha. Tayata Om Mune Mune Ma Munaye Soha. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Now, if you'll please turn the page to the first pink sheet, and at the very bottom you see two mantras. So let's chant Chenrezig's mantra eight times, and Green Power's mantra seven times, keeping in mind the people on our prayer list, and also those dear to your hearts and minds. Om Mani Padme Hum. 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 Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Soha. 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 Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Soha.
Sometimes at the beginning of a Christian service, they'll, as I recall, they'll say something like, let us pray. So I'm going to say, let us meditate. So if you sit comfortably, is there anyone here who's never meditated before? Oh, okay, good. So sit comfortably with your seated cross-legged, that's helpful, with your spine erect. Eyes not completely open nor completely closed. And if I were to say to you right now, listen, you don't have to create any noise to listen to. It's just a passive observation. In the same way, if I say, be observant of your breathing, you don't have to control the breathing. In fact, when you first start to watch it, observe it. It seems awkward, as though you have to control it. Just watch your breathing and recognize when you're breathing in, when it changes direction, and when you're breathing out. And in so doing, let go of all other thoughts. As you breathe out, you can also think you're breathing out the tension in your body in the form of the black energy. It doesn't stay close to you, so you don't have to worry about breathing it in again. Imagine it going off as you breathe out. Imagine also breathing out the nervous mental energy. If you have some unhappiness, resentment, anger, or unfulfilled desires that are constantly chattering in your mind, imagine breathing those out also in the form of black smoke. So in addition to coupling the exhalation with imagining breathing out black energy, negative energy, imagine when you breathe in, you're welcoming positive spiritual energy, maybe in the form of white light from the spiritual beings, the white side of things, the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas. If you're a Christian, imagine breathing in the blessings of Jesus, the Godhead. And that fills you up as you breathe in, forcing out as you exhale all of the negative energy, our angry mind, our jealousy, our pride. And then relax, bring your attention back to the present. And ask if there are any observations. Anyone have any experience just then that they want to investigate? How was your, the two people who said they didn't meditate before, how was your meditation? Yeah. Oh, he wants to bring microphone just so the people can hear. Now, don't be stage
it's difficult. Hard to concentrate my mind.
Because going on to other topics, you mean, or what?
No, I guess just silencing the chatter.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah, the chatter that goes on in our mind. Okay. How about you?
I feel the same way.
So, good observation. Do you think when you are in ordinary state that you don't notice the chatter as much?
No, I notice it all the time.
Oh, you notice it all the time. Okay. Okay. Some people don't. They say they notice it more when they try to meditate. But the reason being, because we're so, how to say, like in, if you're driving down the road, and you're just involved in other things in your car, and there might be many people passing you with out-of-state license plates, but you don't notice, right? But if you actually start to be vigilant, and there's some game that one of my friends in Washington, D.C., he works at the and for the government, and every day he drives from the suburbs in, and he has a little piece of paper, and he counts all of the out-of-state license plates. I don't know why. And then you start to notice there are a lot. So if you are trying to calm your mind, you may notice the chatter a little bit more, but that's natural. And simply being very careful with your concentration to watch one object, in this case it's your respiration, that itself gives the mind less ability to take part in those chattery conversations. They'll still be there, but they'll start to quiet down slowly because you're not paying attention to them. It's not as though they have a mind of their own and they know they're being ignored, right? You know, like I said, you have some friend who's always chattering and they notice that you're not paying attention to them, so they start quieting. Not quite like that, but there's a certain amount of reinforcement some thought pattern will have in our mind because we pay attention to it. You know, we think we're upset because someone did something to us and he did this, he did that, then he did that, he did this, he did it. It's almost like it becomes a mantra. You know, we say again and again, you know. And because because of that frequency, because of doing it again and again, it has a certain staying power. It remains there and continues on. So as we take our mind away from that, it will start to diminish in how strongly that chatter is coming in our mind and how frequently it comes. You know, it may still come after some time you quiet, maybe the chatter starts again, and you it's not as though you try to push it away. You just focus more at that point on, in this case, the breathing, and it may subside again. Over time, both the frequency and the intensity of that chatter will begin to diminish. Okay, so good. That's a good observation. Anyone else have some? Yeah. What's your name? Kalita. Just so other people can hear.
Tightening of the chest.
When you're trying to breathe, you notice that your chest is tightening up?
It's tightening up. So the exhalation is fine, but I have a sense of panic with the inhalation.
Ah, interesting. Okay. You do notice at the beginning what's the technical term for the part of our system that controls the breathing?
Autonomic
system, right? So when you're not, if you're not conscious of your breathing, you're just talking or watching the TV or writing or driving a car, do you notice that tightness then? You know, because it's just normal. But as you are conscious of breathing, you may actually be overriding the autonomic impulses of the nervous system that keep the breathing going. And so you're consciously going, letting out the air is a little easier because you don't have to, the feeling of pulling in. It just naturally will expel itself generally. So perhaps just as I had given the example before of the fact that if I just ask you to listen, you don't have to expend any effort in creating a sound, right? So also here, there is a certain art. I find similar to you, I find the same thing at first. It's almost as though I have to control the breathing, and it seems artificial. There might be some tightness or irregularity. I want to still be breathing in, but the body wants to be breathing out or something like that. So just as I'm talking right now, part of your mind, just watch your breathing and still keep listening to me. Just be aware that you're breathing. A little bit different, maybe a little easier, and then merge into that slowly in a meditative state. Meditative state means concentrating the mind on that. It may help a little bit, but I think I understand what you're saying. It may be just a matter of familiarity, and over time, as you relax into it, you won't feel that tightness. Okay. So, anyone else have something you wanted to share or ask? No? Okay. Oh. Don't bend your body when I'm saying I misinterpreted as meaning you have a question. So, last Sunday, we were talking a little bit about the meaning of meditation, and I'll just briefly say meditation is a special hallmark of Buddhism. Do any of you have some, probably a good number of you have Christian background, maybe some Muslim or Hindu or what are the other religions, Jewish backgrounds. In your own religion, have you heard the word meditation used in your religious services? No. Who said no? No. What others? Christian?
Prayer.
Always prayer. One of the things that often is, one of the words that's used for what we think of, as Buddhists think of as meditation in the Christian tradition, is contemplation. And I've even gone to the extent of asking a couple of Christian theologians and scholars why that is. Meditation seems to be a word in Christianity that refers to something a little bit different, almost more like prayer. And I was told by one scholar, I think this is quite interesting, that the word contemplation comes from maybe the Latin contemplare, which he said, he gave an etymology, to join together with con, like the prefix con, join together with the plan of the temple of God in heaven, contemplare. I thought that was quite nice. And I thought that fit very well with the sense of, one of the senses, one of the aims of meditation in the Indian tradition is what we call yoga. Now, you might think of yoga as some kind of physical You know, like I'm going to yoga class, right? That is, those physical things are not the main meaning of yoga. Do you have Indian background? Do you know what yoga means? What does yoga mean in Hindi? You don't know? Okay. So the root word yoga is it's related to our English word yoke. When you yoke two oxen together, I've got it right. Yesterday I was saying an oxen is plural. When you yoke two cows or ox together, you know what I'm talking about, that thing. So it means to join together into one things that might otherwise be separate, yoga. And the spiritual meaning of yoga, many meditative processes, many kind of spiritual processes, are try to join our present being with the more meditative or sublime spiritual state, to yoke together. And eventually, in so doing, let's say if you think of that particular, say our mundane state, to join together with the spiritual state, the proximity of the two, then our ordinary state becomes more aligned with the spiritual and tamed and so forth. So from a Buddhist perspective, meditation means that joining together with a wholesome state, say a spiritual state, in which we familiarize with it, having, you know, being in close proximity with it in our mind, having certain thoughts or processes in our mind begins to become aligned with those, you know, joined, our mind becomes tamed by them, we become familiar with them, so they become more and more part and parcel of our mind. That's kind of the aim of meditation, okay? It's not some end-all. That's the only thing the Buddhists do, because even everyday activities, walking around and just trying to have a smile on your face, trying to be kind, is a form of meditation. Because you're familiarizing yourself with that. You're watching the benefits of that in everyday life. You know, you see as you smile to the people that otherwise you ignore on the elevator or when you're walking to your building, you notice how the reaction is different. The whole ambiance is different. And that can reaffirm the benefits of that. Okay? Meditation. So we had talked last week, and not all of you were here last week, and some of you are new and so forth, but even though if I have a progression from week to week, hopefully this will be still useful to you. One of the special states of mind that's considered very, very beneficial from a Buddhist perspective that we'd like to familiarize with and generate is a state of compassion. Do you know what compassion means? Anyone? Let's see. This young lady in the very back there, do you know what do you know what compassion means?
Not you.
Not
I just always think of compassion as kindness towards yourself or towards others.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, that's pretty good. The like when I was telling you that what this one Christian told me about the etymology of contemplation, con templare, come passion. There's a similar kind of prefix at the beginning, not con, but com, maybe because of the fact that the next letter, P, anyway, is a grammatical thing. It's to feel along with com, passion meaning to feel. So from even etymologically, you know, just like looking at the definition, it's quite, from a Buddhist perspective, that's quite right on. Having kindness for yourself and others is general, but to be specific, to recognize the suffering of others, you know, their unease, and to you yourself to kind of identify with that, to recognize that. When we feel uneasy, do you like to perpetuate that? No, obviously not. So if you were to feel the unease of others and sort of make it your own, you would have a natural tendency to want them to be free of that also. So that's the sense of compassion. Sensing the unease or suffering of others and having a natural desire that they be free of that. Does that make sense to you? Is that something that rises ordinarily in people in, what's it called, the technology triangle? What's it called here? Research triangle. I thought there were three letters I saw. Park. Okay, so park was not sensitive. Okay, research triangle park. In the research triangle park area, is that something that you notice rising naturally in people, a sense of compassion? It is? Oh, good. Okay. You come in contact with good people. Okay, maybe this is a little more enlightened. It's not like if I were to ask that in downtown New York, might not get the same answer, you know, or, you know, in some other neighborhood that's there's a lot of tension. Oftentimes when there is a separation of myself from others, barrier is put up for whatever reason. You know, there's some threat from other people just because you're having problems or when we're experiencing some kind of pain ourselves. You know, if someone would come up to us and say, don't touch me. You know, it's just like we want to isolate ourselves from any kind of other kind of input or interaction. And anything else is seen as a threat. The talkative neighbor or the talkative friend on the elevator becomes someone we want to, you know, shut up. Or our companions, you know, we might bark at them or our children or our dog. bark at our dog. So in places where maybe compassion is more prevalent, that might mean that there is a little more harmony in the community. In times when you yourself don't find compassion rising easily, it might be worth, in order to develop compassion, to spend some time just walking around and recognizing our identity, our similarity with others, our equalness as human beings. You know, there is a famous expression, famous is not the right word, a well-known expression in I'm not sure if it's Christian or if it's just biblical in general. You'll be able to tell me if you've read the Bible. Thus, but by the grace of God go I. Is that sort of paraphrase? Is that more or less what it is? There but for the grace of God, not by the grace. Okay, so. Meaning of that? What do you take as the meaning of that? Yeah. Take a stab. Have you actually studied that, or you just sort of have thought about it and have an idea?
I thought about it a lot because it was my mother's mantra.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So as from very little on, she was like, "You have no idea what's going on with that person. You could just as easily be you as them." So you you better not judge them because it could be you. She didn't believe in reincarnation, but she was on the road.
Mm-hmm.
And so she taught us that you don't, she really hit home, you do not know what is going on with that other person. Maybe you can find out, but even if you don't do that, at least don't judge them because you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I think also, the kind of the meaning of that. If you just walked in, we were talking about the phrase, I'll get it wrong again, thus for, let me say it again.
There but for the grace of God.
Grace of God, go I. Mm-hmm. So a little bit similar to a Native American expression, and it probably is not just only Native Americans, but some other natives of other cultures. You can't really know another person until you walk two moons in their moccasins.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I was teaching a little boy who was recognizes the reincarnation of my teacher. My teacher's name was Lama Yeshe, and there was a little Spanish boy who was recognized as his incarnation. And for about 3.5 years, I lived at the monastery in South India teaching him English subjects, reading, writing, arithmetic, history, you know, grammar and everything. And we read a book at one point. I think that was the title. Does that any of you ever run across it? It's kind of a kid's book. You can't, walking two moons, maybe it was, that meant 2 months, maybe walking two moons in his moccasins or something like that. Anyway, so you can't really, that's one aspect of it. You can't really know another person until you really think about them, put yourself in their situation. So compassion is a voluntary putting yourself in their situation and recognizing from your own perspective how uncomfortable another person's suffering problems would be if we had to experience that. And recognizing that we're both human beings. Just as I feel discomfort and would like to be free of that, they feel discomfort and would like to be free from that. And maybe making the next step, actually having the thought how wonderful it would be if they were free from that. In the same way it would be wonderful that I was free from my discomfort. Does that make sense? That's kind of the sense of how one would think about compassion. How one way one might meditate on compassion. Because meditating means to familiarize your mind with a wholesome state. Just thinking about it in everyday life and seeing that again and again and having that come to mind, then when you have a chance to sit down quietly and do what we call formal meditation. Formal meditation means when you're not going to be walking down the street and trying to hold your Starbucks in one hand and text with the other and you see someone on the street and you try to half of your mind is trying to have compassion for them, but you're thinking about other things. That's your ordinary state. But formal meditation is when you actually sit down in a quiet place, maybe at your desk, at work, or at a chair in your kitchen, or a little spot in your sleeping quarters, or in your house where you've reserved for meditation. It's useful to have a little spot like that. It doesn't have to be, you know, like with flowers and incense and candles and everything, although it can. But just a place where you do again and again, and whenever you sit down in that seat or on that cushion, sort of like your mind can relax, you can get into that groove of relaxing, letting go of other thoughts, and just familiarize your mind with some spiritual thoughts that will be elevating for you. And so if you were to meditate on compassion formally, that's something you could do. you could start to scan through your memory of the thing, of the people that you've encountered that day, that were, you know, maybe you see on the bus. Does anyone drive, go on the bus here? Two people. Okay, so it's not as much as some places where, you know, 75 or more than 80% of the people would raise their hands. This is more of a, I can't remember seeing a bus around here. They must go on small, certain routes. This can be service, huh? So, or say walking down the street or in the shopping center or whatever, you may see people that, I was going to say like on the bus, just holding on, you know, just looking sort of like their life is a drag and a burden and so forth, to bring them to mind and think in the moments of my life when I might have felt something similar to that, how wonderful it would have been if I was free. And start to identify with other people to think how wonderful it would be if they were free from that. You can start to use various logical reasonings to overcome the tendency of the mind to ignore that. Say, well, sorry, that's their problem. Right? That would be something like a little devil coming up in our mind saying, forget about compassion. That's their problem. You've got enough of your own, right? So how would you counteract that kind of discordant dismissal of compassion? Well, you could start to think how it would still benefit you if other people were happy, because when others are happy, if they don't have those problems, there's less chance of them being aggressive toward you. If the kids on the street that might otherwise pose a threat because they formed a little gang and they're, because of their discontent, they're trying to find some pleasure by, you know, aggravating other people or assaulting, or if they have very little money and they might want to try to, what's the right word, steal, rob, you know, hold you up. What's the term you use in the city? I've been what? Mugged? Mugged? I've been mugged. If the muggers, let's say, were free of their discontent, if they were free of that, if they were free of their suffering, they wouldn't be outside trying to find some other, you know, source of pleasure. They wouldn't be causing the aggravation. They wouldn't be causing problems. Your whole neighborhood would be safer. In your area, maybe this is unusual. In this area, can you leave your house unlocked during the day? Okay, one no. He lives in a good neighborhood, and even then, anyone leave their house unlocked? Don't worry, I'm not. Okay, good. I'm not going to keep. Okay, let's check his house later. I live in the mountains north of Asheville. You know where Asheville is, north to the west. And these 5 weeks I'm here, I probably could have left my house unlocked the whole time, and probably, I'll see when I get back. But when others are not beleaguered by discontent and unhappiness, our life, there's a repercussion to us that things are better. How wonderful it would be if other people were free of suffering, having that thought. That's a thought of compassion. You know, feeling their suffering, wanting them to be free of that. It has repercussions for us. So that's a first approximation because of developing reasonings. Because at the beginning of any kind of spiritual progress, we're always concerned about number one. I think I was saying before, Venerable is Japanese family, right? So correct me, don't people say I, they always point to, I don't know why, some when you say I, if you're accentuating I, do you point to some part of your body? Your throat? Yeah, here, yeah. So it's interesting. From a Buddhist perspective, it's there at the, not the physical heart, the beating heart, but the center of our body that can be called the center or the heart, like the core. In Buddhism, there's even a name, the heart chakra. There's said to be the subtlemost aspect of our mind, not up here in the cerebral region, but, you know, when you say, I told you, don't you do that to me, or something like that, you might point right here. Does that resonate with some of you? That is supposedly indicative of the fact that our very subtle sense of ourself, the root of it comes, you know, is hidden back there in the center of our body and the heart chakra. So because we are generally most concerned with number one. That was a term I learned some years ago. Do they still use that? And then things change. Like number one means me, right? I can't remember what the phrases were I heard when I came back to the States at one point. Take care of number one or something like that. The first take care of number one. Look out for number one. Yeah. Was that a song or something? It sounds almost like look out for them. So as that's a natural tendency, you can use that and think, well, it will profit number one if other people were free of suffering, because there won't be the unease in the community around me. I'll be more safe and I'll feel more secure. I'll feel happier and so forth. That's a legitimate reasoning at the beginning. And over time, as you start to recognize the benefit of opening up your heart to consider the welfare of others, to feel compassion for them, number one won't be the prime concern. You'll start to have a sense of the importance of the happiness, or the suffering in this case, of others, for them to be free of that. So that's a useful exercise. When we meditate on compassion, to meditate on compassion doesn't mean simply to sit and think the words, you know, compassion, or to think of the meaning, wouldn't it be good if everyone was free of suffering? Although that can lead you to the meditation, the real meditation is to actually think that the meaning of that. Wouldn't it be good? You know, analyze. Wouldn't it be good if others were free of suffering? You know, and if there's some little devil in your heart that's saying, no, then you'll feel bad if they're free of suffering. Now you can relish their suffering and feel you're above them, you know. You have to counteract that. What would you say? How would you counteract that? This is the lady here. What's your name? Kim? No. But in front of Kim.
Yeah.
Robin. If that little devil came up, how would you counteract that in meditation? That the little devil that's saying, no, you get a certain kind of satisfaction from the suffering of others because you can feel, you know, better off, and, you know, how would you counteract that?
There, but for the grace of God, go I.
There's a good, yeah, good response. Yeah, it could happen to me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's not as though I'm in a privileged position and I will always enjoy this privileged position. Anything else come to mind?
Well, I do. Years ago, I had an accident. I had an external fixator on my arm. Couldn't use my right arm at all. And mm-hmm. My very first trip to the physical therapist, and I was feeling pretty sorry for myself until I saw a fellow who had both arms in the same situation. Again, there's yeah. always somebody who has a, you know, worse situation.
Right.
Maybe I don't have that devil.
Okay, you don't have that particular devil. Maybe that's just like I've got lots of devils. I'm more familiar with more of these. Some of you may not. You say, what is he talking about? Anyone else have ever encountered that devil that would you know, discount the suffering of others, you know, discount the sense of compassion for others. Like there's no sense of having pity for them, because it gives me a certain kind of sense of elevation to see that they're lower than I, you know. Okay, this is something. What, you have some thought back there?
Right word. Thank you so much. To even admit that, I mean, that I think most people, myself included, will be not that brazen about it, even to ourselves. We might think, well, I worked for what I have.
Ah, right? Good. Yeah. That's
maybe a subtler form of what you're talking about.
Yes.
You know, and so, you know, maybe he'll get the chance to work hard too.
Right.
Or something like that, instead of really, you know, being open to that the circumstances may be far beyond anything that the person could control, and the fact that you have it and they don't has nothing to do really with the work that you've done.
Right.
It's just the way it is. Because it's very threatening to think that, wow, what if they did more than me or the same as me and they have that circumstance, then, you know, what does that mean about the world? I mean,
mm-hmm.
What kind of place is it? It doesn't make sense. Right? So that's I think that the guarding against that is that, well, it must have some order to it. It must have to do with what I did. You know.
I think that there's some ramifications of that, yeah, that are quite prevalent in our society when we oftentimes we see in the literature, or if you follow the internet at all and the comments about articles, whoa, so much aggravation and anger. Do you notice? It's just like everything, so much anger out there that you can have compassion for. You can wish, oh boy, those people must be. When you have, is there anyone here who never gets angry? You put up your hand. All right. I gave a seminar once in Japan, in Tokyo. It was a weekend seminar at a Zen temple. It was on meditation. There were some Japanese people there. There were some expats, some Westerners also. And at one point I asked if there was anyone who didn't have a problem with anger. And most people, like yourselves, they kind of either chuckled or they put their head down, of course. But there were two fellows in suits who had a little bit older fellows, not as old as I am, but businessmen of some kind, and they had young ladies next to them. I'm not sure if they were their daughters or their companions for the weekend or something. And they both put up, two fellows, they put up their hands, and the girls next to them looked at them like, what, you don't, you know, you think you don't have a problem with anger. So we all have a problem with anger. Think about how you feel when anger's there. Sometimes one of the rationales in our own mind that allows us to get angry is, well, there are various rationales, the other person needs it. You know, why did you get angry? Oh, they needed that. Why did you say those angry words? They needed it. Why did you slap him? They needed that. Do you ever hear that rationale? Maybe in your own mind. Or that it gives a certain kind of relief to you. There's some pressure, and then, you know, letting it out. Meditating on compassion, meditating can help to overcome that kind of response. So you become familiar with patience, which is kind of an offshoot of compassion. If you have compassion, you will naturally have a hesitancy to strike out because you know how other people feel when they're suffering and you don't want to heap any more suffering on them. You know, think when you experience suffering, this is an adjunct of your meditation on compassion during the day. If you experience some irritation on the road in a traffic jam, just think, this is how other people are feeling. I don't like this. if you hear some harsh words, if someone criticizes you, or just talks on endlessly, like the you get one of these telemarketing calls from a real person, which is not always the case. I noticed at Robbie's house that it's just something starts talking and you can't get, it's just a recorded message, you know. But if it's a real person and you notice how irritating it is to you, then to think, when I talk to others unbidden, you know, just about my own pet grievance or something, how other people might feel aggrieved by that. Or if someone says harsh words to you, how uncomfortable you feel, think, ooh, I shouldn't say these harsh words to others because I know what that feeling is like. Do you understand what I'm saying? So another thing that can enhance that meditation on compassion is trying to more deeply identify with the other person, with other people in general. Why should you care about them? On one level, just due to number one, I'll use a Japanese point here, or number one, is just because we know we're somehow equal to them. You know, they're human being, and we can kind of identify that. That actually is a very profound reason, very, very profound, but at first it may not resonate with us very much, might be helpful. But to think of the fact that even though now they seem to be a stranger to us or an enemy, that those status, the status of being a stranger or enemy is not something that's eternal, that's fixed. The very friends you have right now were once strangers before you met them, right? Like your best buddies and girlfriends and, you know, before you first met them, they were strangers, but they became your best friends. Let me ask you a question. Is there anyone here who's had the experience where someone was your enemy at one point, you know, or someone that you found irritating, and later they became your friend? Anyone have an experience like that? Okay. Think about it. Maybe there was someone if you go back to kindergarten before you know, you might have had a fight with someone in the sandbox and later they became your best bud. You know, it does happen. Of course, and maybe more prevalent, is there anyone here who's experienced someone who had been your friend later becoming your enemy? Yeah, maybe a couple more people. Some of you didn't raise your hand either, but these kinds of relationships are not eternal. Friend, enemy, stranger. But to recognize, you know, to spend some time meditating on that there is no one who is an eternal enemy. That they could become your friend this lifetime, simply by your changing your attitude. Right now, there may be some people that have been antagonistic toward you, or that you have been antagonistic toward, that you have some hatred for the whole life, or for many years. Simply by changing your mind, opening your mind, and saying some kind things about them, saying some kind things to them, the situation can be different, and they could become your friend again. Wouldn't that be a nice relief? Wouldn't that be a nice relief? I remember speaking in Singapore one time at a Buddhist library there and mentioning this, and there was one woman who came up after the talk and said, oh, thank you so much. I've been so angry at my husband for a decade, and just what you said this evening sort of just broke up this knot, you know, and I'm, you know...